Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast channeling to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to Freaks co-directors Adam Stein and Zach Lebowski. Over the course of our near hour interview, we dive deep into that film, chatting about the story of the film, how the production came together, and its success at various film festivals it played across the world. I also asked them about whether it was intimidating directing a movie legend like Bruce Dern, and in terms of one of the leads, Lexi Colker, the difference between directing child actors and their adult counterparts. Also, while Freaks does take up the majority of our conversation, we also find time to chat about how Adam and Zach first met and how their creative partnership has grown over the years and why they decided to become creative partners and co-direct this particular feature and look to co-direct features in the future as well. Finally, as a wrestling fan, I did want to ask Zach about directing a WWE film and whether there was any kind of funny interactions with Vince McMahon or any funny interference, as Vince is known for that a lot in the wrestling business, so who knows. But I did not find a chance to really bring that up. Really, the conversation mainly was focused towards Freaks, and it was a really good conversation. I really enjoyed talking about that film, and I would highly recommend that you track it down whenever it appears on general release, or if it pops up at a festival near you. But before we get to the interview, I just want to say how much I would very much appreciate if you would rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. Also, remember you can follow us on Spotify and listen to us wherever you get good podcasts. Anyway, now that's done, on with the interview with Adam and Zach. Hi, Adam.
Hello, hello.
And hi, Zach.
Hi.
You're both to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. This is exciting.
That's no problem. It's good to have you on. We're going to talk a little bit about your new movie, Freaks, which premiered at Toronto last September, the Toronto International Film Festival, and will soon be coming to Glasgow Fright Fest towards the end of February. So I know that you want people to go in knowing as little about this movie as possible, but tell us a little bit about it.
So we're not going to talk about the movie at all.
so basically, yeah, podcast is just mainly going to be just silence.
Well, the movie is a very kind of mysterious film, so it's best to go in, you know, not knowing a lot. But what we tell people is that it's a movie about a little girl who's grown up her whole life inside of a house, and she lives there with her father, and he says, if you ever go outside, people will try and kill you. People will kill you, and they'll kill me. And she's believed that her whole life, and she's just starting to get to the age where she's questioning if he's telling the truth or not. And you don't really know what's going on outside or inside. You're trying to figure it out. And near the beginning of the movie, she gets up the courage to leave and starts to find out that he's telling the truth.
And that's as Zach said, that's the first 20 minutes, and kind of goes on a twisty, windy path from there. The father character is played by Emile Hirsch, who turns in an incredible performance. Mm-hmm. It's Emile's first time playing a father, and he recently became a father, so he really brought a lot of firsthand experience to that. And then Bruce Dern also co-stars in the movie, playing a somewhat creepy, mysterious character named Mr. Snowcone, who tempts young Chloe to leave the house and go on an adventure with him that you're not sure if she should join him on. So that's kind of the setup of the movie.
And how did I, because you're both writers and directors, how did you come up with the idea, and how long was it from initial conception of that idea to like getting around to filming it?
Yeah, I mean, we came up with the idea mostly out of necessity. We really wanted to make a film, and we had a lot of bigger projects kind of just keep falling through because it's really hard to get all the different pieces you need to make a film. And we just kind of went on a long walk and decided we needed to make a movie with whatever resources we had at hand rather than trying to get resources we didn't have. And we kind of, you know, a lot of this was inspired by a speech that Mark Duplass gave at South by Southwest, where he told people, you know, we had a van and a puffy chair, and we made a movie about a puffy chair, and that kind of launched our career. So we kind of surveyed the things we had, and we had Adam's house. We had Adam's family runs a restaurant, and Adam had a son at the time, a four-year-old son. So we started thinking about what we could do with those elements and sort of building it around this idea of seeing a movie through a child's perspective, a lot kind of based through Adam's experience raising his son.
When you were writing the film, did you have any particular actors in mind when you were writing the parts? Or
That's a funny question, because as Zach said, we initially thought of writing the film with what we had at hand. Yeah. And our first thought was, okay, if we have to make this movie for $0, we'll just star in it. You know, my son will be the kid. Yeah. I'll be the dad. You'll be the at the time it was the uncle, which eventually turned into Bruce Stern's character. So we at first were thinking we would just do that. And then when we started writing through different drafts of the script and started showing it to people and got a couple of you know, small investors, mm-hmm. and then started showing it to actors and stuff, we realized, okay, maybe we will be able to cast actors who really know what they're doing, instead of just us. And at that time, we didn't really know who would play the parts. We were just hoping to get as talented actors as we could. When you're making a very low budget film, there's a feeling of like just yearning to get anyone to actually even read it. Because often you send it to agencies or actors if you have their contact information. And, you know, it takes weeks and months for them to even open it. So we felt very lucky that people even read it and opened it and started to respond. And then, you know, we found our way to our amazing cast eventually.
And how did the cast come on board? How did Emil come on board and Bruce come on board?
Yeah, I mean, they all came differently. I mean, a lot of both of them were mostly through agents. So you write up a letter, you know, saying why you think they'd be great for the movie, and you send it with your casting director to their agents, and their agents send it to them, and you know, they get lots of those every week, and luckily they responded to our script, and Bruce Dern was the first one to really come on board. You know, he's very excited about playing this mysterious, creepy weirdo, and he, you know, came on board, and that started helping us get other people, because people are really excited about working with him.
Yeah, he actually hasn't done a science fiction movie in 40 years, is it, Zach? 1972? 45 years? Since Silent Running.
Yeah.
Which, you know, he was a younger man back then. But I think he had a kind of bias in his mind that science fiction wasn't real, you know, he wants to always play real characters that are dealing with real shit. Mm-hmm. And he somehow picked up our script and read it and saw that in his character, because his character is motivated by a very personal family issue. involving his daughter, which you find out later in the movie. And he really connected that to that personally. You know, he has a daughter, Laura. And so the idea of doing everything, you know, risking his life for his daughter, was something he really sank his teeth into and became very passionate about.
Mm-hmm. I've got two questions on that. Of one is, from what I've read about the film, from reviews that have come out from other festivals and stuff, and it's very much got a kind of, it's very much got a kind of grounded reality. Was that very important to you that it had that grounded reality? And also, talking about Bruce Dern, was it at all intimidating working across from him, directing him? You know, like, what was the kind of first day on set like? Was that nerve-wracking at all?
Well, the first day on set was pretty, with him, was pretty fun because he'd been really looking forward to working with Emil because he had heard from Sean Penn that Emil was really talented and their characters are really are opposing characters. So Bruce Dern loves conflict and loves sinking his teeth into other actors verbally. And so that first few scenes we did with them were just absolutely explosive. We did, I think, a first 45-minute take of just the two of them going at each other. And the, you know, crew, some of the other crew, you know, in our offices and stuff could hear what was going on, and they all just left their computers and came to watch because they could tell that it was something just special and crazy going on.
Yeah. Leading up to that day, Bruce kept saying, who's the character playing that dad? Cause that guy better be able to fucking dance. Cause I'm going to dance with that motherfucker. Now, I hope I can curse on the podcast, but
yeah, it's totally fine.
I'm talking about Bruce Dern. I mean,
he has a
sailor's mouth. So if I'm quoting him, it'll probably be involve cursing. But he was just, yeah, as Zach said, just excited to dance with that in those scenes where they could just be at each other's throats. Bruce does a lot of improv as well. He's kind of known for that, and we were very excited about working in that way. Even though we had written the script, we weren't wedded to the specific ways that lines were, you know, worded. Mm-hmm. We were just interested in the dramatic tension and conflicts of the scene, and so having the actors kind of riff on the language and put it into their own words is something we encouraged all the actors to do. And Bruce really, you know, that's the way he always works. So that was very exciting.
Yeah. And that kind of ties into your first question about the kind of realism of it. We really wanted to take a incredibly kind of authentic feel to how the world is experienced. We did that with the camera. We did that with the lighting. We did that with the way that they improvised, everything we could to try and just make it feel super real. Cause we felt like as the movie evolves, you really get a sense of the sci-fi-ness. And we really were excited about the combination of sci-fi meeting a completely real, almost documentary kind of feel. Mm-hmm. We kind of thought of it as like, you know, a Sundance movie, but making a science fiction movie. So we try to do that with all the different elements, you know, the camera and the actors.
Yeah, and part of that came, I think, from the initial inspiration of about fatherhood and telling a story about a father and child, and especially accessing the kid's perspective. We wanted that to feel very, very real and very intimate, because often when you see kids act, it can be mannered and fake, and we just really wanted to kind of get at the truth of that relationship and make you feel like this was really happening in front of you. And because our special effects budget and everything was limited, mm-hmm. We felt like telling the story in a very grounded way would help you feel like you're really experiencing the crazy stuff that happens later.
I was wondering, did you take any kind of inspirations from other films? I mean, obviously I know that it spawns out and it has a lot of different elements of psychological thriller and sci-fi, and there's a lot of different things going on, but the early kind of setup sounds quite similar to something like Room or Dogtooth? Was there particularly, did you have particular films in mind and draw any inspiration from things like that? Or were you very much just focused on your own path?
Yeah, I mean, we watched all those movies and we watched, you know, things like Beasts of the Southern Wild and Florida Project and anything that kind of focuses on a kid and does it well as inspiration. But it's kind of funny, like a lot of those films don't put the kid as much in the lead role as we do. like our little girl is like, she's in charge of every scene in the movie and she's got most of the dialogue and she's pushing the characters around. She's, you know, like she's a very, very active, engaged protagonist. Whereas you notice with a lot of these other films, the kids end up being kind of passive and almost sort of like the omniscient observer of the things that are going on with the adults in a lot of those movies. So we really, you know, looked at them for the way that they, you know, portrayed the kids' perspective, and we borrowed on some stuff definitely from the way that Room shot from the kids' perspective. We were inspired by that for sure, and the way that the world looks in Beasts of the Southern Wild was, you know, really inspiring. But we kind of mixed all those ingredients together and tried to make our own dish.
It sounds like there is a lot of kind of emotional heavy listening for your lead child actor, Alexei Kolker. Yeah. Was it a difficult casting process to find a child who could deal with that?
It was. It was very tricky and very nerve-wracking, because even once we had some of the other, you know, name actors, we realized this movie will completely fail if Chloe is bad. You know, as Zach said, she's driving the entire movie. So that casting was the most important thing we did. And we approached it in a very different way. Zach and I, in our sort of careers outside of Freaks, have directed kids a lot. We've done TV work for Disney with a lot of different kids, and we've worked with kids quite a bit. So we sort of had developed some ideas and opinions about how to get the best performances out of them. But when we auditioned for this role, we approached it from a different perspective and really tried to find that improvisational, emotional truth, as opposed to who could deliver the lines the best way. A lot of casting and auditions are designed to kind of get the actors who deliver the lines of the scenes that are being auditioned for. And what we wanted to do is go deeper than that and find young actress who could access her inner emotional life in a very true and very powerful way. So when we did the auditions, we sat on the floor with our shoes off with a bunch of coloring books and crayons, and had the little actress come in and kind of sit on the floor with us and just sort of talk about their lives. And then we kind of transitioned to, all right, you know, when was the time when you were really mad at your parents? Oh, interesting. You know, that sleepover. Let's pretend to do that scene where you ask to go to the sleepover and they don't let you. And we kind of tried to access their real experience about being angry, for instance. And then transition into the scene, kind of throw some of the lines from the scene into that emotional stew and see what happened. And it was really fascinating when we first met Lexi, because she was incredibly fierce in a way that my own son is as well. I mean, that was what inspired the character. And so I recognized that in her, just that kind of, just fierceness of emotion. And her nostrils were flaring and her eyes were tearing up. And we had an actor friend come and read with the kids so that we could pay attention and not be reading with them. And he was yelling back at her and she was yelling at him. And then as soon as we said, oh, wow, you know, cut, that was great, she just flipped it off and said, wow, you're a really good actor. That was fun. And so we could see that she not only could access those emotions, but sort of knew the difference between having that emotional experience as an actor and that it wasn't real. Because we saw a couple other young actors who could get there, but then were sort of confused by it and distressed by it in a way that they couldn't step out of it, which we didn't want to be responsible for that kind of thing either, where we, you know, brought a young actor there and had them disturbed by the experience. But Lexi completely got it, even though she was just 7 years old.
That seems amazing. That shows a lot of emotional maturity for a kid so young.
Yeah, I mean, people, the first thing everyone says when the credits roll is, who is that girl? They don't even talk about Emilia Bruce. She just totally, she is the thing that kind of drives the movie, that you really are just blown away by her performance.
So, because it was kind of darker material, was it very different directing her to the previous kids you directed and the kind of TV stuff you've done, the Disney stuff?
I mean, it was, you know, it's still kind of all fake when you're on set. So there's sort of a fun, you know, haunted house kind of element to you know, when you're shooting, because it's all make-believe in that respect. But definitely you try and build a trust and an environment with the crew and everyone so that they feel safe to be able to go to those deeper emotional places. And her parents were really big supporters as well, and they were always there, and her sister was there as well, helping her a lot. So she was surrounded with a lot of love and a lot of support. And so even though what you see on screen can be quite disturbing and quite, you know, intense, we tried to make sure the set didn't feel that way.
Emil was very instrumental in that as well. As I mentioned, he's a father now. I think he has a 4-year-old at this point. And he was very aware of being protective of her when the cameras weren't rolling. She, for instance, she doesn't wear shoes, really, for the whole movie. And because she lives inside this house her whole life. So he was, for instance, every time they would walk to set, he would be like, you know, have a hand on her shoulder and looking out for anything she might step on so that she wouldn't get hurt, you know?
Yeah.
It was just very, like, kind of protective and nurturing of her. And that really helped their bond on screen as well. But it was just one of those things that made her feel safe on set.
Because, I mean, I suppose not only her performance, but the relationship between the father and daughter, it has to be strong to give it that grounded reality that you were talking about. The chemistry, I mean.
Definitely, yeah. We even had them before they even came to the set, you know, a week or two earlier, we had them go on little field trips together to the zoo and stuff, just to kind of create that bond.
Since the movie premiered at the Toronto Film Festival, it seems to have got a lot of plaudits. You've won a few awards at different festivals. You must be really pleased with the reaction that the film has got so far.
Yeah, I mean, we went to the film festival in Toronto with the plan of selling the movie. That was sort of where all our energy was being put towards, because, you know, you raise all this money to make a movie and then you hope you can sell it for more than that. And we were able to do that, which was really exciting. But that wasn't sort of the emotional climax of it. What, you know, we really were sort of blown away by the reaction of not just fans, but also reviewers and stuff, really not just celebrating the movie, but noticing so many of the details we assumed nobody would ever see. Because you spend so much time, you know, putting in little tiny details to kind of build the world. And it was incredibly overwhelming to have people kind of notice those and celebrate them. It was just sort of like, you know, years and years of work. And then having just fans and other, you know, professional fans like reviewers be, you know, impacted by that. And you could tell in some of the reviews that people had spent a day writing the review. It was so thoughtfully written. And then having gone to film festivals around the world, you know, it's been just absolutely incredible to be, you know, I was in Italy and France, and to be in a room with 900 Italians or 900 French people who don't know us. They have no reason to be there because they owe anything to us. They just have heard about this movie and they've spent an hour lining up for it, and they've got babysitters, and they've come because they think it'll be worth their time. And then to have them just, you know, be so thankful for the experience of seeing the movie is very, very overwhelming. And it's funny when you compare it to, like, you know, a YouTube video with 900 views is like nothing, but being in a room with 900 people that are just sharing an experience like that is incredibly overwhelming.
And do you feel the same way, Adam? Was that?
No? Well, yeah. I mean, it's when you're a filmmaker and you're writing a movie, hoping that it gets made somehow by some miracle, you almost have to put it out of your mind, like, will anyone ever see this? there's a feeling of like, we just want to get this made. We just want to have the experience of making this thing. And, you know, yes, you think, oh, hopefully people will see it down the line, but I think it's exceeded all our expectations in terms of people seeing it and appreciating it and liking it. And as Zach said, the reviews have been incredibly exciting. And I think we never really expected this kind of level of response. We're just very grateful to everyone who comes and sees it. And, you know, we've both been working for many years to try to do something like this. We've been sort of at first aspiring kind of, you know, wannabe filmmakers. And then we kind of have been lucky enough to kind of scrape out a living directing for hire on various things like commercials and TV episodes. But this is the first sort of personal project we've created and written. And so it's incredibly, you know, overwhelming and exciting that people are seeing it and responding to it.
It must feel very different when it's a kind of passion project as opposed to being just a director for hire.
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of crazy to think we just sort of had a blank page and just sort of like came up with an idea and then convinced people to give us money to do it and then made it and then got the money back and then got to show it to people. Like, just, you know, that's been pretty surprising, you know, along the way, just to think that we kind of created it out of nothing. Because for all the for hire work, there's always sort of a project or money already in existence. So really to do something like this, that's our own from beginning to end, has been very rewarding.
And how long did the whole process take? I take it this is over a number of years from just writing the script.
Yeah, we probably spent 2 years, I think, but from the time we first came up with the idea to the time we started shooting, sort of a year of really just writing and rewriting, and then a year where the rewriting continued, but we were also trying to raise money and find actors and stuff like that. And then shooting it was less than a month. And then we spent another year finishing it and doing post.
I don't know why I expected it to be even longer, but that's cool.
It is funny that Zach mentioned we took a walk and kind of first discussed wanting to do this, and on that long walk we came up with the germ of the idea as well, and we hadn't brought anything to write it down, so we just hit record on our phone, you know, voice memo thing, and started spewing any thoughts about the idea that we had from that walk. And it's really funny. We've listened to that a couple times recently, and a lot has changed in the rewriting and editing process. But some scenes are, you know, exactly as we came up with them on that first walk, and it's really crazy to think about an idea coming to life like that.
I was actually going to ask that because I was wondering, given what you talked about, the kind of improvising that Bruce and the other actors did, how different the film ended up being from where it started with your original script.
It's pretty close. I think it's just that they would kind of put a line into their own words, or, you know, add a little bit to the end of it or something. It's not like they would make a whole new scene or anything like that. We would just, you know, we always believe in when we're writing, you basically kind of, you set up what the character's goals are for the scene, you set up what the conflicts are and stuff, and you kind of mix those together. And pretty much when people improvise, they're improvising within that container anyway. They're they're improvising as their character trying to achieve that goal, just like you do when you're trying to write the dialogue to achieve that goal. So, you know, some of the words are different, and there's definitely lines that came out of it that are way better than we wrote. But in general, sort of what's happening and what the scene is the same.
The thing that changed the most over the process wasn't necessarily the improvisation, but was a kind of process experiment that Zach and I did throughout the whole writing and editing process of the movie that was inspired by Pixar's process. There have been a couple of books written about how Pixar works, including one called Creativity Inc. by Ed Catmull. And, you know, Pixar, no matter, you know, they have some movies that are incredible and some movies that are just solidly good, but they're always good. They're never terrible. And what they achieve, the way they achieve such consistent greatness is through this process of iteration and candid feedback from their core trusted group of advisors. And they write the script, they present it, they write it again, and they just really kind of keep going in a way that live action movies are rarely done. A lot of times, whether it's indies or studio movies, they're kind of created and then rewritten based on the feedback of very few people, mm-hmm. executives in an office or, you know, just a few friends. Mm-hmm. But what we did was we wrote the first draft of the script, and then we did 4 or 5 staged readings of it with actors.
Right.
With full rewrites.
Go ahead, Zach. What'd you say?
Full rewrites in between each of those readings. We didn't do four in a row.
Yeah. So we would do a reading, basically present the script as if it was complete to a small audience, and get very detailed feedback from the audience, encouraging complete candid honesty, even though it hurt sometimes. Like, what is this piece of crap? What are you guys doing? I don't understand this at all. And from those readings, we would completely rewrite the script and change how we were doing things, and then do it all over again and kind of beat ourselves up again and again and again to hone the script. And then when we filmed it, we did probably, you know, 10, 12 editing screenings. Once a week, we would do a screening of the cut, sometimes two at once in different cities, to see where the overlap was of the feedback, so that we really could figure out what people were getting, what people were understanding, what they hated, what they were confused by, so we could hone and hone and hone and really, you know, make the movie as good as it can be. We both have post backgrounds before we became directors. And one thing I noticed as an editor, because I edited many independent films, and I noticed that directors would do a screening or maybe two screenings, and they would be very defensive about the feedback. You know, an audience would say, I really don't like this scene, or this part felt slow, or I didn't really get this. And the directors would often have a kind of defensive chip on their shoulder of, well, no, it's working. They don't get it, but it's working. I know it. I know better. And sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm just meaning, I was just going to say, I can imagine that there's a lot of directors who are probably very precious about their vision, their particular vision they have in their head, but it sounds like...
Yeah, well, we think you can still be trying to achieve something and have vision of what it is you're trying to achieve, but be open to hearing if you're achieving it or not. Like, you know, we have very specific ideas of what it is we're trying to do, but we want to make sure it's actually being achieved. So, you know, we ask a lot of specific questions about what we're trying to do. If they tell us it's not working or it's not achieving that, or they didn't understand that thing we're trying to do, we'll spend all week trying to change the movie to achieve it and test it again. And if they still say that, you know, if they still don't get it, then we know we didn't fix it. That's the thing is, one test screening is sort of useless by itself. You need to at least do two to kind of see if you fix the thing that everyone was talking about. And often you haven't, or you've only fixed it 20% of the way. You know, some of the things in the movie took 4 or 5 test screenings for us to finally get to the point where the audience, you know, said that they understood it or they liked it.
Yeah.
So it took a lot of that iterative work. But, you know, that's really led to, I think, a film that audiences really enjoy, because we've seen it, we tested it in front of so many audiences. In the traditional kind of Hollywood system, they usually only test the movie in front of an audience once it's done. And they're just seeing if they should market it a lot or not, which is a really terrible point to decide if the movie's good or bad.
And they're not testing to see if they're achieving the goals of the movie. They're kind of testing it as a trump card over the filmmakers. Like, hey, you know, filmmaker, you're trying to do this, but the audience said they didn't like that, so we're going to change what you're doing. Obviously, we didn't have any studio, so we weren't doing that kind of thing. But for instance, the movie, you know, is a mystery, as we said. Things are revealed very slowly and in a way that is meant to be satisfying by the end. But we didn't want to be over the top or obvious about things either. So in trying to kind of craft that right balance, yeah, there's a lot of leeway into when you reveal things, how clearly you reveal things. And striking that balance was not something we could do on our own, because we already knew all the answers. We already knew what the mysteries were. So, we needed the help of an audience.
The first time we did a reading of the script, we thought, we just wrote this first draft, we're just absolute geniuses. This is the best script ever written. It's so clever. It's so smart. It's so subtle. It's so like brilliant in the way that it, you know, unravels the mystery. And we got to the end and everyone was like, what happened?
It must have been a very difficult balancing act, because it sounds like it's quite a complex plot, and you don't want to make it too convoluted, but you don't want to dumb it down to the extent that it's, you know, like, you know, there's still mystery in it. There's still surprises.
Yeah, I mean, that's just sort of the chemistry of the movie. It's complex, but I feel like where we landed with it, that anyone can enjoy it. It's not like you need to have a film master's degree to enjoy the movie. The film is very accessible, I think, but it took a lot of work to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I'd even say that what's interesting about the movie, and the reason we're so protective of spoilers, is that it's actually a pretty straightforward world, but it's all told through the little girl's perspective. So it's all told from the perspective of a 7-year-old girl who's never left her house and doesn't understand anything about the world. So the mystery is all what she's trying to unravel, and you as the audience are trying to unravel it with her. So that's kind of the fun of the movie. It's not like it's, I'm trying to think of a movie that's kind of confusing and mysterious, like The Fountain or something, where it's like, what is this movie about? What is happening? It's not quite like that. It's more like you're with her on her journey, trying to figure it out.
I see. Because yeah, there is movies like that. The Fountain's a good example. I was also thinking of like Primer.
Right.
Yeah, that way you need like a kind of like a whiteboard and to try and work out all the kind of time
travel like
going on.
Certain points in our movie, probably at the very beginning, you might feel tinges of those of that experience. But I promise you, it all clearly is, you don't need a whiteboard to figure it all out at the end. It all becomes very clear.
Yeah, and part of that is because of these, you know, iterative steps we took, because we wanted to make sure that everyone by the end, you know, got it and understood it. But in a way that, you know, unveiled in a rewarding way.
And it's interesting when you ask groups of people, because there's all sorts of different reveals and mysteries, everyone figures it out at different times. You know, some people, all they need to hear is a certain sound effect and they figured it out. Other people need a whole monologue to explain it. And so it was interesting because we would, during the tests, we'd realize, okay, by this point, probably 20% of the audience knows this. By this point, 50% of the audience knows this. Like, it's not an absolute because everyone is, you know, watches movies differently. Yeah. And that was an interesting thing to kind of learn.
One of the things that we were also inspired by, you asked about other movies that inspired us. Mm-hmm. One of the things that inspired us is we love movie experiences where you can't predict what's going to happen. And I think that it's a particular problem in genre movies, because often when you sit down to watch a horror movie or a sci-fi movie, you know kind of what's going to happen by the end. You know that, you know, there's going to be, everyone's going to get killed except for one character, and they'll probably succeed, or maybe they'll get killed at the end, but, you know, there'll be a final girl. Or, you know, if you're sitting down to watch a Marvel movie, that, like, okay, there's going to be a villain, but then the heroes will win in the end. Or, you know, it's gotten, for fans of genre films, which we are,
yeah,
it's gotten kind of enervating and kind of depressing to sit down and watch a lot of the kinds of movies we like, because it's sort of predictable. But some of our most exciting, most favorite movie-going experiences have been when we don't know what's going to happen. And so we were really trying to craft a movie like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think there's a lot of that kind of thirst for things that are a bit different, a bit new, that don't just follow kind of all the genre beats. And, you know, it's been much discussed on kind of horror websites of this kind of what's been seen as this kind of rejuvenation of horror, and that all these kind of weirder horrors and things. Like last year there was like Hereditary and Mandy, and the year before that you had like Get Out, and they're not just your typical straightforward horror, that there's a killer and there's a bunch of dead teenagers and there's a final girl.
Definitely. Well, I think that's, you know, that's people's response to any, there's generally this ebb and flow that happens with every genre. You know, you saw it with found footage, for example. There's sort of something unique at the beginning that gets everyone excited about a new idea. Then probably one or two other kind of interesting approaches to it. Then just an onslaught of completely derivative, boring crap that kind of borrows on the idea, trying to make money, that burns out, you know, the audience and everyone's desire to see that type of stuff. Yeah. And then sort of like a cooling off period, and then someone goes, hey, what about this? And it's a new take on that thing that everyone used to love that got kind of scorched earth. So yeah. I think you see that in every genre. You know, you see that with rom-coms, you see that with superhero movies. So there's always this up ebb and flow of like people coming up with a cool new idea that invigorates a genre, but then gets kind of overdone and dies off for a little while, and then someone reinvents it again.
Yeah, it kind of gets recycled and recycled to the point that nobody cares. Or quite often there's something that happens like in direct opposition to it. You know,
There's sort of a gold rush feeling of like, oh, someone's come up with a new way of trope or new kind of spin on making a certain type of movie. So then a whole bunch of people try and do it, and they kind of tropify the genre. Like they basically turn, you know, found footage is a good example. They start making so many of them that the uniqueness and creativity of it is completely taken away, and you can't even really make a good entry into the genre because it's just become a trope. Yeah. But then there's always a movie that figures out a way later on to kind of reinvent it. But it's just basically, often I would say it's probably commerce coming in and trying to to make something without that original spark that invented it?
Absolutely. I think found footage is an interesting example, because like it had like a kind of mini boom straight after Blair Witch, and then that died down, but then it had like a much bigger thing after Paranormal Activity, and it would take something to reinvent found footage, I think, at this point.
Yeah, I mean, there always is. You know, we started getting non-horror found footage movies like Chronicle, and you know, there was even time travel found footage movies and stuff. So, you know, it'll find its own way soon again. But you know, in some ways, there's those movies that are now. There's movies that are entirely like screen captured off someone's laptop as they're having Skype calls, which is sort of like, you know, found footage 2.0. So,
I suppose that's true.
It'll keep evolving. You know, it's that's really just a representation of sort of how people consume media.
Going back to Freaks, I was going to ask about how does it work directing wise. I know you've both directed things individually. How's it work, the kind of creative collaboration?
Yeah, basically I do everything and Adam just, you know, sits back and does
nothing. Yeah, it makes it really easy for me. I get half the credit.
They'll get the credit in that, and this is all good.
So Zach and I met 11 years ago now. Mm-hmm. Jeez, is it 12 years ago now, Zach?
Is this on the show On the Lot?
Yeah.
In the 11 and a half. It was the summer of 2007.
So we met on this thing called On the Lot, which was a reality show competition for directors. And we were both, you know, young, aspiring filmmakers who had kind of worked in post and done a bunch of our own shorts. And we were competitors on this show where we had to make a new short film every week. And we became, you know, very close friends in that process. And even while we were competitors, we helped each other on our films and realized how much we had in common. And after that opened a lot of doors for us and kind of helped us get our first jobs as working directors, which was very, you know, exciting. And we ended up working a lot separately as directors, but came together over the years and collaborated on writing projects and short films and web series and stuff like that. And as we mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, mm-hmm. over the years sort of started to feel like our careers were out of our control, that it was, we were kind of having to, we took whatever came to us, because, you know, when you're trying to make a living as a director, like, you do whatever you can. whoever wants to hire you, you say yes, because you're just so excited to work as a director, which makes sense, which is great. But then after you've done that a couple times, it can be a little bit like, well, I did that, but now I'm known for this, and I don't really want to be known for that. I want to do this instead. At the same time, you're trying to get the kinds of jobs you really want to be making, but often those don't happen. People don't realize like how many years you can work on a project that then never gets made. So because we were both sort of doing that in parallel, and collaborating together on smaller kind of passion projects, we realized, okay, you know what? Now's the time to work together on something bigger. And we came up with Freaks. Zach, do you want to speak to the question of like how that actually works?
Yeah. I mean, in general, we kind of both do everything, but we do a lot of, you know, talking and brainstorming and planning privately, is to make sure that we're kind of as on the same page as we can be together. It's obviously a lot easier during the writing and prepping stage, because you're not in the time pressure cooker of shooting. But we basically, you know, talk through everything and collaborate. And there's always stuff that one of us sees differently than the other, and we always kind of, those end up being usually the most interesting conversations, because what comes out of that is, you know, Adam wants A and I want B, and we discuss, well, why do you want B and why do you want A? And out of that usually comes C, which is way better than either A or B. And so we kind of take that process, and on set, you know, there, it's a little bit more complicated just because of the nature of shooting is sort of a fast paced, kind of environment. And in that case, we kind of trade off who sort of is the voice to the crew and the actors, so that there's still sort of a singularity of voice to the crew and to the actors, so they're not getting two different sets of instructions. But we also and we kind of switch back and forth almost every other scene. And but there's a big benefit to that, because it's not like the other one's just not doing anything. When you're a director, sort of, you often want to be like right next to the camera, right next to the actors, like right in the thick of it, you know, making the sausage right right in front. But what you lose then is often a perspective of the whole piece. And so often one of us is up front while the other one is at the monitors, kind of just sitting back, watching what's happening. And you get a much different perspective of, did we get that? Do we need this? Oh, we forgot that the scene is about this. And so the, you know, whoever isn't really up front will walk up and kind of whisper into the ear or give a nod or say go again because we didn't get it or it was out of focus or whatever. So we find that the collaboration through the whole process just ends up with such a better product because of that collaboration. It takes a lot more work, and it takes a lot more patience, and it takes a lot more kind of calming of your ego to be able to share all of that with someone. But we,
is there any time where you're like, no, I want it this way?
Yeah, I mean, we always tend to say, well, why, what is important about what it is that you want? Because it's not usually the I want it red and I want it blue. It's like, well, why do you want it to be red? And why do you want it to be blue? And the answer to that question usually is some interesting piece that we hadn't previously discussed. Well, because the scene is about the cold nature of her inner soul. Well, I thought the scene was about the warmth of their love. They're like, oh, well, we need to reconcile that. You know, well, maybe this character thinks it's about love and this character thinks it's about, you know, coldness. And so how can we represent that? And, oh, well, maybe if the, what if the wall was green? Oh, that would be so much better. Like, you know, like, so we, you know, and there's always times where it's easy enough to do, you know, choice A and choice B if time and resources allow. And, you know, in the edit, you can often edit it two different ways and watch it and see which one, you know, has the most of an effect. But we, never really needs to come down to one or the other. And in general, we've discussed everything and created everything together. So the vast majority of the time, we already are on the same page. Vast majority of the time, we're just trying to convince other people of it. So we're in their strength in having each other's backs when we're trying to do that.
I mean, you say you both have kind of similar tastes and are coming from, yeah, maybe it's the more genre influences, or is that how you kind of clicked?
Yeah, we have, you know, we like all the same type of movies, and we generally, you know, have the same reaction to the same, you know, to movies. I think, but we're still different people. We still lean towards different strengths. You know, I think I've had other partnerships in the past, and in those partnerships that haven't worked are the ones where the skill sets weren't complementary. You know, it's, we definitely have things that each of us are better at than the other, and we like that because it, together we're stronger than we would have been as individuals. And so it kind of is it's on a basis that we generally like the same movies and are inspired by the same things. But you know,
there's also just, there's such a rewarding experience to be able to have a trusted, excuse me, trusted ally that you can close the door and talk to about something that isn't working. Because as a director, as a solo director, you are the the ultimate kind of arbiter of creative matters, especially on set. And if something's not working, it's on you to figure out how the heck to figure it out and improve it, or to just lie to yourself and say it's working. I've seen that a lot happen with directors where you know that there's something that's not working and they just, it's fine, moving on, we got it. And then later they have to come to terms with the fact that what they got didn't work. But with Zach and I, we can kind of stare at something and then, you know, huddle in a corner and this isn't working. What do we do? How do we fix it? And we can have that kind of instant brainstorm to fix it.
There's also been times too where there's been times where I'm like, yeah, it's working, it's great. And Adam's like, no, it's not. I'm like, what do you mean? We got it. It's awesome. He's like, no, it's not. We didn't get it yet. And you know, he goes back in and gets something that totally surprised me that I wouldn't have, you know, that I didn't even see was there, you know, because just having more eyes on something, you know, is always valuable. So
absolutely. I can very much imagine that. That's, in terms of going forward, are you brainstorming any other ideas together? You got any projects coming up? I know you've just done the Kim Possible live action movie, which I presume is again a more kind of director for hire kind of thing. Is there any what more kind of indie productions that you're thinking of, or are you just kind of doing the tour, the festivals, continuing with the festival tour and concentrating on that, on Freaks?
Yeah, we're writing all sorts of things. We have we're pitching all sorts of cool new ideas for movies. We're also seeing if maybe we can turn Freaks into a TV series. There's been a little bit of interest on that side of things. And yeah, we're also, like you said, right in the end, the kind of marketing push for Kim Possible, which is a really fun movie, very kind of epic action adventure movie for kids. You know, we're in that hustle mode where we're looking for jobs. We're trying to create our own jobs. We're trying to write cool ideas. The life of a freelance artist.
Yeah, we're unemployed and knocking on doors to try to sell our wares.
Well, I mean, it looks like it's going well. So certainly from all the things I've read about Freaks, I can see it being. That's the other thing. Has it got a kind of confirmed kind of more general release date? I know it's supposed to be coming out sometime 2019.
Yeah, probably late summer is kind of the general plan for it to get a theatrical release in the US, and then other territories like the UK would release probably around the same time. And then it's going to be at the Glasgow Fright Fest. I'll probably be there as well at the festival. And
just yourself or with Adam as well?
Adam's another festival.
We have other festivals the same time, so we're dividing and conquering there. Zach's going to the UK, and I'll be in Miami.
And will that be the first time coming to our shores, Zach?
I've been to London quite a few times, but never.
That's England. That's not Scotland.
I'm very aware. Yeah, so I've been to shores adjacent, but never there. So I'm very excited about that.
I'm sorry about that. I'm just playing the uppity Scotsman.
Totally. I mean, that's basically the main reason I'm coming, is to experience, you know, that whole new country.
Well, I wish you the best luck with the Fright Fest screening. And all the other screenings for Freaks.
Well, thanks so much, Scott. Really hope you enjoy the movie and hope all your listeners check it out when they can.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you again for being on the show. Great to talk with you.
Thanks, Scott. Take care.
Bye.
That was my guests, Adam Stein and Zach Lipofsky there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show and congratulate them on that Fright Fest screening, which went down a treat with the Glasgow audience. And, as I can see from Twitter, the film is continuing to bowl over festival audiences now and will hopefully be in a cinema near you very soon. Before I gen on out of here, It is just left for me to say thanks again for tuning in, listener. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher. Plus, remember to listen in next time, where I'll be chatting to Swedish director Christian Soderstrom. Anyway, see you next time.